7. The Great Deception. Conspiracy of Silence and the Latest Research. The more you know, the more you doubt. Voltaire, 1694 to 1778. My book, The Eyes of the Sphinx, appeared 4 years ago. In it, I examined the unsolved riddles and mysteries of ancient Egypt, and also discussed several theories about the building of the Great Pyramid. Since then, new discoveries have come to light which I cannot keep quiet about. What is their connection with the theme of this book, with the Second Coming and the return of the extraterrestrials? The ancient Egyptians regarded Enoch as the builder of the pyramids. Enoch, Idris, and Sorid are the same figure, according to Arabic tradition. Enoch wrote over 300 books, which he entrusted to his son Methuselah, in the hope that the latter would pass them on to the future races of the world. None of these books has yet been discovered. Have they perhaps been concealed in airtight chambers of the Great Pyramid? May we find there the answers to our questions about the Day of Judgment and the return of the gods? And is someone trying to keep this secret hidden from the world? In the last 2 years, the events surrounding the Cheops pyramid in Egypt have clearly shown how simple-minded the scientists think people are, and to what extent the media are manipulated and in turn manipulate public opinion. On 22nd March 1993, at exactly 11:05 a.m., a sensation of the highest order occurred. Something took place that was unexpected, unthinkable, and beyond the comprehension of all classical Egyptologists. A bomb could not have made more of an impression on Egyptological perspectives. And yet these shockwaves were channeled, dampened down, rendered harmless. And what was very likely a still greater sensation, the event of the millennia, comparable with the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence, was blocked and prevented. So what events were these? The German engineer Rudolf Gantenbrink, born on 24 December 1950 in Menden, had accomplished a stroke of genius. A small, technically extremely refined robot of his invention had, after passing 60 meters along a previously unknown pyramid shaft, arrived at a door upon which were mounted two metal clasps. The robot had been rattling along this narrow shaft for the past 2 weeks and had continually come up against obstructions that it had to circumvent. Several times it had to be electrically ordered back to the starting point so that small technical alterations and refinements could be made to it. Gantenbrink's robot weighs 6 kilograms and is a caterpillar-type machine, only 37 centimeters long. It is driven by 7 independent motors, whose microprocessors are directed by remote control. At the front are 2 small halogen headlights, as well as a mini video camera of the Sony CCD type that can swivel and tilt. Although it has a light aluminum structure, it is capable of carrying a weight of up to 40 kilograms, thanks to the specially made rubber caterpillar tracks which can find footholds on both floor and ceiling. Rudolf Gantenbrink has himself been responsible for all the decisive aspects applied in the development of this unique apparatus. He built it himself. The mechanical precision work took months to complete, a good deal of sweat, and 100,000 pounds which he himself invested in this masterpiece of engineering. He received technical support from the Swiss firm Escap in Geneva, specialized motors, from Hilti Limited in Vaduz, drill technology, and from the firm Gora in Munich, specialized cable. Gantenbrink's robot is a wonderful example of what can be achieved if, instead of saying, "That will never work," one applies a combination of intelligence, technology, and willpower. And what led Rudolf Gantenbrink to think it worthwhile to put all this time and energy into penetrating the Great Pyramid? Surely everyone knew that there was nothing more to find there. The radio and TV reporter Thorsten Sasse from Berlin questioned him and received this reply. "The whole thing began when I was in Egypt during the Gulf War. I had suggested to Professor Stadelmann of the DAI the German Archaeological Institute, that it would be worth taking a closer look at these ventilation shafts, which is what they were still called at the time, since now we possessed technology that would enable us to do this, and because these shafts were also the last part of the pyramid to have remained unexamined. In 1992, we investigated the upper shafts with a video camera and set up a ventilation system to see whether the fresh air would emerge at possible outlets. Already in 1992, we ascertained that these shafts definitely emerged somewhere, but we did not know where or how. This was the starting point of all my investigations. The subsequent project was called Upuout 2. I must explain this name to you. The robot was so christened at the suggestion of Professor Stadelman. Upuout is an ancient Egyptian god and means opener of the ways. Upuout 2 was developed solely in order to investigate the two lower shafts. Which lower and upper shafts are we talking about here? The Great Pyramid contains three chambers, and in Professor Rainer Stadelman's opinion, this is the case in all Egyptian pyramids. Stadelman is thought of as the inventor of the three-chamber theory. Every tourist who makes the effort to climb into the Cheops pyramid can visit two of these chambers. The upper one is called the King's Chamber, rather hopefully since no mummy was ever found there, and the other, somewhat smaller, is named the Queen's Chamber. From the higher chamber, two shafts lead diagonally upwards. These have been called air shafts. In these, Rudolf Gantenbrink set up his ventilation system. Tourists noted this in the fresh air that flowed back into the King's Chamber, but only for a short time. The system no longer functions. This has nothing to do with Rudolf Gantenbrink, but with the pyramid attendants who, for some reason best known to themselves, continually forget to turn it on. From the lower, smaller chamber, two shafts also lead off. One directly south, the other in a northerly direction. The shaft openings are therefore opposite one another, and at the same height as the end of the entrance tunnel. Rudolf Gantenbrink's robot entered the south shaft. The third chamber lies in the rock beneath the pyramid. It is called the unfinished chamber. What do the specialists think is the reason for the shaft leading from the Queen's Chamber? They are not agreed. Some thought them to be soul shafts, others model corridors, and finally they were believed to be the mouths of ventilation shafts or air shafts. This last idea was nonsense, however, since the shafts were only opened in the last century by breaking open the walls. In 1872, the Englishman W. Dixon was trying to locate hidden chambers by knocking at various parts of the chamber walls and listening to the depth of tone. When he found a hollower sound, he grabbed his pickaxe and revealed the openings of the air shafts a few centimeters beneath the stone surface, both shafts of square proportions, 20 by 20 centimeters. Two things, at least, are crystal clear. First, they cannot be air shafts, for these would have had to lead into the chamber to function, and secondly, they must have been part of the original plan of the pyramid. It would have been impossible to carve them in or hollow them out after the pyramid had been built. Not even a child can fit through a gap 20 centimeters square. The two shafts of the Queen's Chamber do not lead diagonally upwards like those of the King's Chamber. They first enter the wall horizontally, then begin to climb at an angle of exactly 39 degrees, 36 minutes, and 28 seconds. Most Egyptologists were agreed that the shafts end after a short distance, until Rudolf Gantenbrink's robot, Upuout, suddenly proved them wrong. The Opener of the Ways. On 22nd March 1993, it was as hot as usual on the Pyramid Plateau of Giza, and inside the Great Pyramid it was as humid as ever. Rudolf Gantenbrink had set up an improvised table in the Queen's Chamber, made from two boxes and boards. Upon this stood his electronic station and monitor that relayed crystal-clear pictures from the robot's camera. A video machine was also set up to record the film sequences. While a colleague carefully fed the specialized, very thin and lightweight cable into the shaft, an Egyptologist from the Egyptian Ministry for Ancient Monuments watched the screen with ever-increasing astonishment. Gantenbrink directed the robot's small steering lever with total concentration. The whole team was under pressure of time, since the Ministry for Ancient Monuments had decided to bring a halt to these investigations that very day. Too many travel agents were complaining because they were not able to take tourists into the Great Pyramid while this was going on. The ministry was also losing money, since entry to the pyramid is not free. Meter by meter, Gantenbrink's miniature monster crept up the steep passage. The headlights on the front illuminated scenes that no one had seen for at least 4,500 years. Cheops, who was said to have built the pyramid, ruled from 2551 to 2528 BC. The slow journey passed smoothly polished walls. The robot had to surmount small piles of sand and maneuver itself cleverly over fragments which had fallen down from the ceiling. At last, after 60 meters, came the first surprise. On the floor lay a broken-off piece of metal. Shortly afterwards, the great sensation. The robot camera relayed a kind of door or partition which closed off the whole shaft. On the upper part of the door were two small metal clasps, the left of which was partly broken. Rudolf Gantenbrink steered the robot towards the door, aiming the laser beam at its lower edge. The red beam, 5 millimeters across, disappeared under the edge of the door. This showed that there was space beyond it. At the lower right-hand corner of the door, a portion of stone was missing. The robot camera relayed dark dust there, which had no doubt blown out of this tiny opening in the course of thousands of years. But the robot's journey had now come to a halt. Michael Hasse, a mathematician from Berlin, worked out the position of the mysterious door. It lies in the south wall of the pyramid, at a height of about 59 meters above ground, between the 74th and 75th level of stones. If the shaft which is blocked by the door continued at the same angle, it would reach the outer wall of the pyramid at a height of 68 meters. The horizontal distance from the door to the outer wall is about 18 meters. Rudolf Gantenbrink naturally climbed up the south wall to investigate, but there was no sign at all of any exit to the shaft. The sensational news concealed. The discovery of a 60-meter-long shaft inside the pyramid is one sensation. The door blocking it off, another. One might have thought that Gantenbrink's efforts and achievement would be properly valued by Egyptologists as a once-in-a-century discovery. If an astronomer discovers a new star or comet, it is common for it to be given his name. That is why I now call the new shaft the Gantenbrink shaft, as do my colleagues. The narrow-mindedness and jealousy of the Egyptologists, on the other hand, takes a different view. Others, they say, had already suspected that the shaft existed. That is only a quarter of the truth. It is true that people knew of the existence of the horizontal shaft openings which lead from the Queen's Chamber in both northerly and southerly directions, but no one was aware of a 60-meter passage inside the pyramid. On the contrary, people blustered about soul shafts which end after a short distance. And theories are not discoveries. All sorts of things may be suspected. But it is only the German engineer Rudolf Gantenbrink who discovered the 60-meter passage and the door at the end of it. Gantenbrink himself is not interested in sensationalism. His prime concern is to preserve ancient remains. At the same time, he wants to inject archaeology with new life and rejuvenate it by means of new technology. He is a hard-working, honest fellow who likes to solve puzzles and who places his experience and brilliance at the service of a fascinating science. But none of this, apparently, is appreciated. Gantenbrink was given the cold shoulder. After the discovery of the Gantenbrink shaft, nothing at all happened for a while. Although the specialists in Cairo and in the German Archaeological Institute, DAI, knew of the discovery, there was nothing but icy silence from them. The public were not informed. No one was allowed to say anything, and the public would still be in the dark to this day if Chance and Gantenbrink himself had not done something about it. Gantenbrink showed a copy of the extraordinary video that the robot had taken to a few colleagues. Then the British press got wind of it, and only 2 weeks after the discovery, published a tiny article entitled "Portcullis Blocks Robot in Pyramid." This article also reached Cairo via fax. What was the reaction? The DAI in Cairo denied the news. "That is absolute rubbish," said the Institute's press officer Christel Egorov to the news agency Reuters. According to her, the discovered passage was only an air shaft, and a mini-robot had just been measuring humidity. It was, she said, well known that there were no other chambers within the pyramid. "Not only may we feel deceived by this, but we are being deceived. The archaeologists of the DAI in Cairo were fully aware that their statements were false. The robot that journeyed down the Gantenbrink shaft had absolutely no instruments on board for measuring humidity." It gets worse. Dr. Rainer Stadelmann, the great chief of German Egyptology and director of the DAI, denied that there was any possibility of a secret chamber behind the shaft door. He said to journalists, "It is common knowledge that all treasures concealed within the pyramid were plundered long ago." His colleague, the Egyptologist Dr. Günther Dreyer, backed him up. "There is nothing behind that door. It's pure imagination." Before I relate how the esteemed circle of Cairo Egyptologists got rid of Rudolf Gantenbrink, I must elaborate on the opinions people have had about the interior structure of the pyramid. It is nonsense to assert that there is nothing inside the pyramid apart from the three known chambers, and that there could not possibly be anything behind the door. If the archaeologists of the DAI were to say that it is not known whether there is anything behind the mysterious door, they would be right. But to claim categorically that they know there is nothing there is not only dogmatic and unscientific, but also, to echo the words of the DAI itself, absolute rubbish. Knowledge of the ancients. Let us backtrack a bit and have another look at history. In the 14th century, there were ancient Arabic and Coptic fragments lying in Cairo libraries, which the geographer and historian Al-Makrizi compiled in his work Hittat. There we can read, "Whereupon the builder of the pyramids had 30 treasure chambers of colored granite fashioned in the western pyramid. These were filled with instruments and images made from precious stones. With tools of the finest iron, such as weapons which do not rust, with glass that can be folded without breaking, with strange talismans, with all kinds of simple and compound medicaments, and with deadly poisons. In the eastern pyramid he had the various spheres of heaven and the planets depicted, and images made of his forefathers' creations, also incense that is offered to the stars, and books about these. One also may find there the fixed stars and what comes about in their progression from one epoch to another. And into the colored pyramid, finally, he had the corpses of the truth-tellers and soothsayers brought, in coffins of black granite, and beside each soothsayer lay a book, in which were written all his wonderful arts, his life's story, and the works he had accomplished." And who is supposed to have had these mighty buildings erected? Cheops, as the Egyptologists assert? The Hittat, as I have already mentioned, tells us. The first Hermes, called the Threefold One, because of his qualities of prophet, king, and wise man, he whom the Hebrews call Enoch, the son of Jareh, the son of Mahalalel, the son of Cana, the son of Eno, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, whose name be blessed, and whose name is also Idris, read in the stars that the flood would come. Then did he have the pyramids built, and had hidden in them treasures, learned texts, and everything which he feared might otherwise be lost, so as to protect them and preserve them. It is not only in the Hittite that Enoch is named as builder of the Great Pyramids. In the 14th century, the Arabian traveler and writer Ibn Battuta says the same thing. Enoch erected the pyramids before the flood to preserve within them books of knowledge and science, as well as other valuable objects. It is hardly necessary to mention that Egyptologists dismiss these Arabic traditions. They are sure that the builder of the pyramids was Cheops, even though there are so many convincing arguments against that point of view. I have gone into this in detail in my book, The Eyes of the Sphinx. The archaeologists behave as though they were deaf, blind, and dumb. I can just about accept, though reluctantly, that they may not want to heed 14th century texts, but the fact that they also reject the evidence of modern science, if it does not accord with their holy doctrine, seems to me unbelievable. Examples from the last 25 years speak for themselves. In 1968-1969, the winner of the Nobel Prize for Physics, Dr. Luis Alvarez, undertook an examination of the Khafre Pyramid using radiation. Alvarez and his team made use of the well-known fact of physics that cosmic radiation is constantly bombarding our planet and, as it penetrates solid matter, loses a proportion of its energy. Exact measurement can reveal how fast the protons are penetrating a layer of stone. If the stone contains hollow spaces, the protons are not hindered in their passage to the same extent. Alvarez measured the paths of over 2.5 million particles with the aid of a transmitter and an IBM computer. But the oscillographs showed a chaotic pattern, as if the particles were curving around the Earth. It was baffling and infuriating. The very expensive experiment, in which several American institutes, IBM and Cairo's Ain Shams University were involved, ended without any clear results. The head of archaeological research at that time, Dr. Amir Gohed, told journalists that the findings were scientifically impossible. He added that either the structure of the pyramids is chaotic, or there is some mystery here that we have not explained. The archaeologists generally ignored these baffling results. Dating the Sphinx. In 1986, another attempt was made with new instruments and methods to search for hidden chambers in the Cheops Pyramid. The two French architects, Jean-Patrice Dormion and Gilles Guadin, discovered various hollow spaces inside the pyramid with the help of electronic detectors. But this did not alter the entrenched opinion of the Egyptologists. Since one of the sponsors of this investigation was the French Electricity Board, the research was written off as an advertising stunt. The next major investigation was by a Japanese team of scientists from Waseda University in Tokyo. Using the most advanced electronic equipment, the Japanese specialists X-rayed both the interior of the Great Pyramid and the whole surrounding area, including the Sphinx. They found clear indications of a whole labyrinth of passages and chambers inside the Cheops Pyramid. They presented their results in a report that was a model of scientific procedure. And what did the Egyptologists say? That this research was, of course, just publicity and promotion for the Japanese electronics industry. The DAI team in Cairo are apparently not interested in anything at all, and their colleagues in Europe and elsewhere generally know almost nothing about what happens on the Giza Plateau. If it was up to Egyptologists, no research would need to be done, for they know everything already. In 1992, the geologist Dr. Robert M. Schoch of Boston University's College of Basic Studies, together with other scientists, undertook geological measurements and analysis of the Sphinx. The results showed that it is at least 5,000 years older than was previously thought. People generally believe that the pharaoh Khafre, 2520 to 2494 BC, built the Sphinx. This is not because any real proof has been provided, but because the name Khafre is still just about decipherable on a crumbling cartouche, if one is determined to read it in that way. This half-erased name does not even belong to the Sphinx, but to a stele of the pharaoh Thutmose IV, who ruled more than 1,000 years after Khephren, from 1401 to 1391 BC. But how did Schock arrive at his opinion that the Sphinx was at least 5,000 years older than Khephren? His team planted a number of seismic receptors in the ground. Then sound waves were generated, which allowed a survey to be made of what was beneath the surface, a method which has continued to prove useful in the field of geology. Computers worked through the data and spewed out long strips of drawings, which reproduced an exact underground plan of the Sphinx. There were very clear traces of weathering at a depth of 2.4 meters, which were absent from the rear end. But at that rear end, repairs had been carried out long after the Sphinx was built. During his rule, Pharaoh Thutmose IV had had the Sphinx dug out of the sand and repaired. The geological measurements and chemical analysis pointed to only one possible conclusion. The strong signs of erosion and weathering stemmed from a time of prolonged rainfall, which had not occurred in Khephren's time. Like tree rings, it was possible to date this erosion to at least 7,000 BC. And the archaeologist's reaction to Schock's data? A storm of indignation. At a conference in Boston, Mark Lehner of Chicago University described Schock as a pseudoscientist. Lehner's main argument was as follows. If the Sphinx was really so old, there must have been a culture at that time that was capable of erecting such a work of art. But in those days, human beings were just hunters and gatherers. Finito. It is human nature, perhaps, when one runs out of reasonable arguments and one's back is up against the wall, to use insult and abuse. This is, at any rate, what happened in the debate between the archaeologist Mark Lehner and the geologist Dr. Robert Schock. Lehner accused his scientific colleague of suspect credibility. Why this unfair attack? One of the sponsors of Schock's geological investigation was a certain John Anthony West. And Mr. West was guilty of two heinous crimes. First, he was not a scientist. And secondly, he had already published books in which he posited the existence of a civilization older than any we so far know. Sacrilege in the eyes of a real archaeologist. The archaeologists are not interested in the fact that Schock was by no means the only geologist who was involved in the seismic measurements on the Giza Plateau. Among the team's members were also Dr. Thomas L. Dobecki, two other geologists, an architect, and an oceanographer. No one paid any attention to their firm conviction that the lowest parts of the Sphinx clearly contained water channels, which could only have been formed as a result of long exposure to water. Dr. Schock's geological analysis was roundly condemned by the current director of antiquities at Giza, the Egyptian Dr. Zahi Hawass, as American hallucinations. According to him, there was absolutely no scientific justification for Schock's new dating of the Sphinx. So it seems that Egyptologists have no interest in results which do not suit them, even if they are scientific ones that have been obtained by proper scientific methods. They determine what the world should believe. They do not notice that they are actually sawing the branch on which they are sitting. Public opinion is tired of trusting in science, and a branch of science which only accepts other branches when they confirm its own views deserves little trust. Another of the exact sciences is physics, and at the Swiss Technical College, ETH, in Zurich, Professor Dr. W. Wolfli is recognized as an authority. He has perfected the long-disputed process of carbon dating, by means of which the age of organic material can be measured. Professor Wolfli, together with several colleagues from other universities, analyzed 16 different materials from the Cheops pyramid, among which were charcoal remains, splinters of wood, straw, and grass fragments. The result? All the samples were an average of 380 years older than the Egyptologists had deduced from the list of kings. One sample from the Cheops pyramid was in fact 843 years older than it was thought to be. The physicists had examined a total of 64 organic samples, and applied a variety of methods. All samples without exception produced datings that were several centuries older than the ones favored by Egyptologists. But no conclusions were drawn, no new perspectives were considered. On the contrary, the old position was, if anything, cemented with new excuses. And if you think excuses is a harsh judgment, I personally consider it too mild a term for the rubbish that we are expected to swallow whole. Discrediting Gantenbrink. The Egyptologists of the DAI want Rudolf Gantenbrink off their hands. Why? Did he not make a spectacular discovery with his robot? Did he not spend much time and money in the service of archaeology, helping to advance the state of knowledge? Was he unscientific? Not at all. His results can be repeated by anyone at any time. Was he impolite or unfriendly? By no means. Gantenbrink is a very pleasant kind of person. Did he start all sorts of unscientific rumors and speculations? No, again. He spoke to the media in a very cautious, reserved fashion. He always stated clearly that nobody knew whether there was anything to be found behind the stone doorway in the newly discovered shaft. He refused to speculate about it. So what did he do wrong? Why is he persona non grata to the Egyptologists of the DAI? He spoke to the press. He did not run to journalists and trumpet his discoveries to the world. The journalists got wind of his phenomenal discovery through British scientists and sought him out. It is, after all, the job of journalists to follow up and investigate interesting trails. But Rudolf Gantenbrink did not try to get any mileage out of this fact. He remained measured, factual, and decently circumspect. Should he have lied and led the journalists up the garden path? Gantenbrink is not a politician. In a report from the German press agency, DPA, of 27 June 1994, the journalist Jörg Fischer writes, "Once more, as on many occasions in the past centuries, the gigantic pyramids of Giza are at the center of mysterious and mystical imaginings. The robot expert Rudolf Gantenbrink from Munich independently announced his discovery to the press and said that he suspected there was a burial chamber behind the doorway. Some German tabloid has already found the ashes of a pharaoh and a treasure of gold," commented DAI Director Professor Rainer Stadelmann about the nonsense, he says, has been written on this subject. The words here attributed to Gantenbrink are unfounded. He never expressed the view that there was a burial chamber to be found behind the doorway. The media, who know no better, have here been roped into the service of a professor who wants to discredit and sideline Gantenbrink's work. Gantenbrink never independently volunteered information to the press, for he was never a member of the DAI, and therefore never subject to any information restrictions that this body might have tried to enforce. The DPA report that was passed on internationally and formed the basis of many newspapers' reports achieved the professor's aim of misinformation. People were supposed to believe that Gantenbrink was publishing unscientific imaginings. This, in turn, so annoyed the Egyptian government that it withdrew permission for further research into the pyramid shafts. Scholarly error. This all becomes clearer later in the DPA report. The archaeologist Dr. Rainer Stadelmann categorically excludes any possibility of a chamber. After examining the pictures relayed by a remote-controlled video camera and comparing them with what is known of three other pyramid shafts, he believes his opinion to be confirmed that the shaft is a model corridor. The opening which leads upward from the Queen's Chamber was intended, in accordance with the religious beliefs of ancient Egypt, to allow the soul of the pharaoh to ascend to heaven. The black dust lying in front of a stone block at the end of the passage comes, according to Stadelmann, from the eroded metal clasps on the model doorway. His sobering theory, and the fact which he has constantly repeated, that people would be quite unable to crawl through the narrow shaft, let alone hide a sarcophagus or a treasure there, has been largely ignored. Anyone who does not share the professor's theory is, of course, living in cloud cuckoo land. I can understand why he categorically excludes the possibility of another chamber. It was he, after all, who came up with the three-chamber theory. The discovery of another chamber would not fit well with this. One realizes what lengths he has gone to safeguard his theory, if one considers that the empty spaces we know of in the pyramid amount to 2,000 cubic meters, and that the Great Gallery takes up 1,800 cubic meters, while the other chambers share the remaining volume between them, but that the Great Gallery is not allowed to be considered a chamber. And what about the model corridor idea? Let us just think about it for a moment. The ancient Egyptians built the most perfect structure in the history of the world. It consists of about 2.5 million stone blocks. The initial planning must have been phenomenal. All the blocks and struts fit perfectly and exactly together. It is a building for eternity. Within the pyramid, a passage is placed which we now call the Great Gallery. It leads diagonally upwards to the King's Chamber, is 46.61 meters long, 2.09 meters wide, and 8.53 meters high. Since the passage walls incline towards each other as they rise, the roof of horizontal stone slabs only measures 1.04 meters. The gigantic granite blocks on either side of the 8.5 meter vaults do not lie in the horizontal plane, but, as if to shake us out of our complacency, follow the rising angle of the Great Gallery. The workmanship of the blocks and slabs is of such perfection that the visitor is hard put to find any cracks or joins. Before one reaches this Great Gallery, one has to bend one's back and creep through the ascending passage. We still do not know why the builders first made a narrow, low passageway that led into the Great Gallery. But Professor Stadelmann, with a somnambulist certainty, knows that the Gantenbrink shaft is a model corridor, from comparison with three other shafts in the pyramid. Holy Osiris! Where in the Great Pyramid are there any other model corridors that one could compare it with? They have always been known as air shafts. The Gantenbrink shaft is supposed to be far too small to allow a sarcophagus, let alone a treasure, to be transported through it. But why, then, is there a granite sarcophagus in the King's Chamber with dimensions greater than the ascending passage? According to Professor Stadelmann's logic, it ought not to be there. And this miracle of building, intended to survive to the end of time, the architects of ancient Egypt were supposed to have introduced a model corridor. Yet it is concealed, and actually does not lead directly out of the Queen's Chamber. The connecting openings were only knocked through by Mr. W. Dixon about 120 years ago. Through this model corridor, the soul of the pharaoh is meant to fly up to the stars. The only problem with this is that a pharaoh never lay in the small Queen's Chamber. And even if a corpse had been deposited there and the shafts had been opened from the beginning, the pharaoh's soul would not have had clear access to the firmament. According to the Egyptologists, the Gantenbrink shaft is blocked off by a stone behind which there is nothing. Poor pharaoh! The sobering theories of the renowned Egyptologists and the repeated statements that people could not have crawled through the narrow shaft, let alone have hidden a sarcophagus or treasure at the end of it, edge very close to being complete nonsense. Let us consider another possibility, another way of looking at the whole thing. The clever archaeologists only consider that the Gantenbrink shaft leads out of the Queen's Chamber. But what is to stop us thinking that it also leads down into the Queen's Chamber from above? Behind the mysterious door of the Gantenbrink shaft, there may, not must, be a chamber, which has another upper entrance shaft, whose opening may also be walled over just as the shaft opening in the Queen's Chamber was, before Mr. Dixon took his pickaxe and broke through into it. To put it another way, if a robot had traveled down the Gantenbrink shaft from above, it would have come to a halt in front of the wall blocking off the Queen's Chamber, if this had not yet been broken through by Mr. Dixon. And all the top archaeological brass would have united in the opinion that there could be nothing more behind it, and no one would have bothered to pierce the apparently final blockage or to dissolve it with acid. Is that scientific? Where is the curiosity, the striving for knowledge? How can it be stated a priori and categorically that there is nothing more to be found behind the door of the Gantenbrink shaft? And how can everyone who begs to differ be dismissed as a deluded lunatic? At the end of the shaft, Gantenbrink's robot filmed two metal clasps on the stone door. The fact that they are metal cannot be disputed, for, thank goodness, a piece of metal is broken off and lies upon the ground. Since only copper at best was available in Cheops' time, these clasps are called copper with enormous assurance. But they may well not be. Yet Professor Stadelmann and his top brass Egyptologists have provided a natural and reasonable explanation, which he described to the radio and TV journalist Torsten Sasse. What is this copper handle for? At first we thought that it might be there for some kind of technical reason, but given its thinness, I would now exclude that possibility and assume that it is a decorative hieroglyphic sign. And if that is the case, then it has some symbolic content. We must therefore ask what its significance is. It could perhaps be the lotus flower sign, which is symbol of the south. Or perhaps more likely the sign Shuat in ancient Egyptian. That is a kind of sunshade that is carried behind the king when the royal train processes. If this is what they are, then they could be there ready for the soul of the king to make use of when he flies up to heaven. Good heavens! What a load of unjustified interpolation! The Great Pyramid is wholly anonymous. We know nothing whatsoever about the team of architects and building engineers, or about the priest or pharaoh involved in its construction. There is not a single inscription to give us a clue about how it was built. Nobody left any hint which could help answer a single question about the building of the pyramid. In the pyramid itself there are no hieroglyphs, no walls covered in writing such as we find in other ancient Egyptian grave sites. Cheops, the supposed force behind its construction, is thought to have been a despot who had the idea of leaving behind him the greatest building of all times. Yet he and his servants forgot to praise him in either text or image. Not one little inscription was placed there in honor of the pharaoh Cheops. Nowhere can one discover any record of a heroic deed of this supposed egomaniac. All the walls, corridors, and chambers of the Cheops pyramid are polished smooth. They have never, now or in the past, been decorated with a single word. Perfect anonymity. And yet we are supposed to believe that at the end of the Gantenbrink shaft is to be found the hieroglyph Shuat, placed there so that the pharaoh can rise to his ancestors without suffering from sunburn? It is an idea that does not, to put it very mildly, strike me as likely. At the lower edge of the door, at the end of the Gantenbrink shaft, a small triangular portion is missing. It is there that the robot eye caught sight of a small streak of black dust. Professor Stadelmann thinks this is dust from the eroded metal of the metal clasps. But let us ponder this for a moment. The learned Egyptologists think the Gantenbrink shaft is just a model corridor that has been blocked off at the end with a stone. But in this case, there would be not the slightest breath of air or wind. It is only the left piece of metal that has broken off, yet the dust lies in the right corner. Have dust spirits been at work? And if the metal clasps had quietly rusted over millennia, the black dust should lie along the lower edge of the door directly beneath them. But it does not. It eddies out of the small triangular hole as though a very faint draft of air had blown it through. Such a faint draft suggests that the Gantenbrink shaft extends beyond the door, or that there is a chamber behind the door into which another shaft leads. The 5-millimeter-wide laser beam of the Upuat robot also passed under the door. Whether it is a door or final blocking stone, it does not lie flat on the shaft floor. Should that not make us think? Obviously not. The Egyptologists have agreed with each other that this is a model corridor, so no further research is needed. Squandering trust. On 5th August 1993, the director of the Egyptian Museum in Berlin, Dr. Dietrich Wildung, wrote in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, "The Egyptologists no doubt have reason to thank the technical expert Rudolf Gantenbrink. Yet the latter is unable to resist the temptation to win himself a sensational kind of publicity and has begun splashing about cluelessly in the swamp of pyramid mysticism and imagined treasure. And lo and behold, here comes Erich von Däniken onto the scene, interpreting the black dust at the lower edge of the stone slab as a sign of the concealed mummy of King Cheops. And where an untouched mummy is to be found, the priceless treasure cannot be far behind, which since Herodotus has stirred the imagination of the world. The automatic mechanisms of trivialized archaeology start up their routine, and the more cautious and careful specialists are dismissed as yesterday's men, who are loath to jettison the ballast of traditionalism and intellectualism. This is the kind of rubbish with which Egyptologists spin their comfortable cocoon and disparage those who think differently. I never dreamed of thinking that the black dust indicated that the mummy of King Cheops lay behind the slab. This idea came from David Keyes, the archaeological correspondent of The Independent. I would never have come up with such an idea, since I do not believe that the Cheops pyramid belonged to Cheops, let alone that it contained a grave. What, then, do I believe is to be found behind the blockage in the Gantenbrink shaft? Probably the same as is hidden in all other still undiscovered chambers, texts and documents of all kinds, as was suggested by the Arab historians of the 14th century mentioned above. David Keyes drew people's attention to another curious thing. The vertical distance between the Queen's Chamber and the King's Chamber is 21.5 meters, which is exactly the distance between the Queen's Chamber and the door at the end of the Gantenbrink shaft. Is this chance or clear evidence of another chamber? The DAI experts would now like to investigate the north shaft leading out of the Queen's Chamber. Rudolf Gantenbrink had also thought of that. I personally think one should first finish the task in hand. There have been various suggestions for opening, breaking through, or even corroding the door. Why are the opinions, work, and knowledge of someone like Rudolf Gantenbrink suddenly not wanted? How can academics, who are otherwise usually very reasonable and open-minded, even humorous, suddenly react in such an eccentric and disagreeable way? I can only imagine that they are envious. Top archaeologists are hurt in the depths of their psyche because a non-archaeologist has succeeded in making an unexpected discovery. They are bitter because Gantenbrink spoke to the press. Or do they want to conceal what might be found behind the door? Do they want to keep any discovery to themselves, safe from the rabble, and take their time in secretly evaluating it? What is indisputable is that the scientists in Egypt have no wish to have any public interest or involvement in what they are up to. Any information they dispense is censored by them. They no doubt want no journalist or neutral observer present when the mysterious door is forced open. They want no TV camera relaying pictures of whatever discovery is made to the outside world. They want no one else from any other branch of science to analyze the metal clasps on the door. And this childish secretiveness is, the Egyptologists say, only to allow them to pursue their investigations in peace. I can understand this desire. But this is not some insignificant grave. It is the Great Pyramid, which has fascinated humanity for thousands of years. It is the most gigantic building on this planet, a wonder of the world, a monument around which legends and stories have grown up through the millennia. Egyptology is missing its one chance to demonstrate to the world at large that its procedures are correct and scientifically rigorous. It is squandering the possibility of showing the loonies and mystics, who believe there are secrets and conspiracies behind every corner, the unadorned facts, of showing what is actually there, once and for all. Or are they actually terrified of what they might find at the end of the Gantenbrink shaft? Archaeologists were not so jumpy in the old days. When the graves of Tutankhamun and Sekhem Ket were opened, journalists were allowed to be present. Since then, global media networks have been developed which would allow the live images from Gantenbrink's robot to be relayed simultaneously to millions of homes around the world. There would be no need for a horde of journalists to squeeze into the Queen's chamber and upset anybody's peace and quiet. But live pictures are what is needed, shot as the discoveries are being made, not edited pictures which are released days, weeks, or months later, and provided with an unctuous legend of some sort to make it palatable to the status quo. Just imagine if the Americans undertook the moon landing in secret, and weeks went by before NASA released censored images to the world. The outcry would be completely justified. What are you keeping from us? What have you got to hide? Why should we taxpayers finance an organization that treats us like children? The Egyptologists of the DAI and the Egyptian Ministry for Ancient Monuments behave as though openness is a threat. Those who avoid public scrutiny and cloak themselves in secrecy have something to hide. If one starts off by concealing something, one ends up having to perpetuate the deception. As long as the information politics of the Egyptologists expends itself in secretiveness and avoidance tactics, the public will have no reason for believing anything they say. It does not matter how many earnest and honest-seeming people announce that, as expected, nothing was found behind the door of the Gantenbrink shaft. Public opinion will not be fooled, for the Egyptologists have missed their chance to be trusted. The old Roman historian Cornelius Tacitus, AD 55 to 120, said it all. Those who dislike criticism show that they deserve it. This concludes The Return of the Gods. Tantor Audio is proud to present a bonus interview with author Eric von Däniken.
Eric von Däniken's first book, Chariots of the Gods, became a worldwide bestseller following its publication in 1968 and has been translated into 32 languages. Tantor Audio is very pleased to be releasing for the first time on audio four of Mr. von Däniken's books, Chariots of the Gods, Twilight of the Gods, The Eyes of the Sphinx, and History is Wrong. And we are very honored to have Mr. von Däniken with us today as our guest. Welcome, Mr. von Däniken.
Well, welcome myself. Happy to be with you on the phone.
Thank you so much. Now, of course, you are the Swiss author best known for your claims about extraterrestrial influences. And this is a topic that has really been popular since 1968, since your very first book, Chariots of the Gods. And, of course, we've had movies and a television series, and there's a current series on History Channel now about ancient aliens. And all of this can be attributed to your early work. And so I was wondering if you could tell the listeners, what was it? What were your earliest experiences, and at what age did you first have the feeling about these ancient aliens?
I was educated in Switzerland. I am Swiss, and I was educated for 6 years in a Swiss boarding school led by Jesuits. So I was a strict Catholic. And in my boarding school, we had also to learn Latin and Greek. And we had to make translations for some parts of the Old Testament of the Bible. Now, you have to understand, I was a very, very deep believer in God. By the way, I am still a deep believer in God. I'm one of these persons who still pray. But for me, as a young man, God had to have a few minimal qualities. For example, God would never make mistake, or God would never use a vehicle to move from one point to the other, because God is all over. We say he's omnipotent, etc. Now, by making translations from the Bible, especially from the book of the prophet Ezekiel, I had of a certain doubt in my own religious education, because the prophet Ezekiel describes, by the way, in the first person as an eyewitness, he describes a vehicle who descends from the sky. He describes the wheel of the vehicle, the wings of the vehicle. He describes the noise which the vehicle makes, etc. He calls all this the splendorness of God. Now, of course, as a young man, I asked my professors, what's this all about? And the professor said, well, Eric, you have to consider this as a vision. Ezekiel had a vision. But I could not believe in the vision because it was too natural, the explanation. So I simply wanted to know if other communities in antiquity also have similar stories like the ones we find in the Bible. And so I started to research. And finally, I came up with a hypothesis, or with a speculation, if you wish, that our ancestors must have seen some extraterrestrials long, long time ago. Now, at that time, our ancestors were Stone Age people. They could not understand what was going on. So they believed, of course, erroneously, they believed that these extraterrestrials were some kind of gods. We all know that there is only one God. But that was the misunderstanding in the past, and that's how it all started.
It's almost 50 years since the publication of your first book. Why is this still capturing the imagination of young people and older people?
Because so many things have changed in the past 50 years. You see, after Chariots of the Gods, I was, for example, attacked by some of the scientific community. They say this is all ridiculous, because no extraterrestrial, even if they would exist, they would never be able to visit us, because there are distances with the speed of light, and the next stars are far away, so they could never reach us. In the meantime, we see quite possibilities how interstellar space travel would be possible. Or I speculated at that time that some of these gods made some genetical experiments with our ancestors. Of course, I was ridiculed. In the meantime, we know that such genetical experiments are possible. Our genetics are doing it every day. And so on, the situation has changed completely. Also, I know, and we know, much more of the old texts today than we knew 50 years ago. So many new old texts have been found in ruins all over the world. And this is my speciality, to find it, and if possible, to translate it. And if I'm not able to translate it, so I hire some professors who make translations. You see, in the beginning, in the old texts, we always hear, for example, that some humans, some of our forefathers, were taken into the heaven. Now, the word heaven, in the religious sense, means a place of happiness, a place where you are united with God, with the Lord, after death. In the meantime, we understand that the word heaven in ancient texts was not just a religious meaning. Heaven was also space. So space is not the same thing as heaven. You see, the sky is up there. Some of our ancestors were taken into the sky and were brought back.
You have over 24 books, and they've been translated into 20 or more languages. Can you tell us, are you working on any books currently?
Of course, I'm always working. You see, I have a very big archive, and in my archive, I have about 60,000 pictures, which I made over the last 50 years worldwide. And at the moment, I'm working on 5 volumes of a picture book. Every volume has just 200 pictures, so with 5 volumes, we will have altogether 1,000 pictures. I show the most incredible things in archaeology which exists around the world.
Before we end our conversation today, I think my son, who is a big fan of yours and of ancient aliens, would like me to ask you, what do you think is going to happen in 2012?
The Maya calendar has a starting date. And the starting date of the Maya calendar, if we translate it into our Christian calendar, is August 14th, 3114 BC. That was the starting point of the Maya calendar. Now, every normal calendar has no ending date. For example, in our Christian calendar, we can go on and count and count. We can say, now it's September 2014, or so on. Not in the Maya calendar. The Maya calendar has an ending date, and you can translate the ending date into our calendar, and out comes December 23rd, 2012. Then the Maya calendar ends. Now we have Maya writings, even in some stone pyramids, where they say, at that date, a god with the name Bolon Yokte, that's the name of one of these gods, Bolon Yokte will return to Earth. So that would mean that on December 23rd, 2012, some extraterrestrials would return to Earth. Fantastic. The only problem we have is the calculation of the calendar. The specialists in Maya language, Maya astronomy, have calculated the starting point, as I said before, to August 14, 3114 BC. If this translation into our calendar is wrong, then the end date, 2012, will be wrong too. So we have traditions of the Maya which says some of the gods will return, but I would never count on the date. They will return one day, but if this will be in December 2012 or later or maybe earlier, nobody knows.
Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.